From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally. And this morning we speak first with solar eclipse enthusiast and former science correspondent for National Public Radio, David Barron, who writes about the earliest eclipse chasers in 1878 in his fascinating book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. And don't forget, the total eclipse in 2024 is coming up on April 8th.
Just around the corner. Then in the second half, we speak with author Anne Berg, who has written a young adult biography about the life of Rachel Carson, the naturalist, marine biologist, and author of Silent Spring. Anne's new book is called Force of Nature, and it shows young and old alike how important it is to find your voice, your passion, and the importance of all creatures who walk the planet. That's all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
On April 8th, a total solar eclipse will pass through the United States in a southwest to northeast trajectory from about San Antonio, Texas to Burlington, Vermont, and hitting places in the Midwest in between, like Indianapolis, for example. Our next guest is an umbrophile. Okay, there's a word of the day. It's an eclipse chaser. He's also an award-winning journalist and author of The Beast in the Garden and a former science correspondent for NPR. He's written a fascinating book on the topic of the earliest umbrophiles. There's that word again. It's called American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. David Barron, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
We're really happy to talk to you about the eclipse. And I believe that since the 2017 total eclipse passed so close to all of us here, you know, Park City, and you just had to travel a little bit north, people became umbrophiles. And then there was the annular solar eclipse last October. You've been an umbrophile for how long?
Well, for almost 30 years. I saw, it was a partial eclipse I saw, actually an annular eclipse in 1994. That I saw in New Hampshire. And an annular eclipse is sometimes called a ring of fire eclipse. At its peak, the sun turns into a very thin ring in the sky. You can't look at it with the naked eye, but through eclipse glasses, the sun looks just like a wedding band. So I saw an annular eclipse in 1994, and that convinced me to go see my first total eclipse in 1998. And that was truly a life-changing experience. It was the most extraordinary thing I'd ever witnessed. And I got addicted. I've now seen 8 total solar eclipses on 5 continents. And I ended up writing my book. My life really does revolve around chasing eclipses.
So we're talking to you from Boulder, Colorado, where you live. And you, of course, on April 8th, will be viewing the total eclipse from where?
I will be in Waco, Texas. So as you said, in the United States, the path of totality, as it's called, this year goes from Texas to Maine. I would say the bulk of serious eclipse chasers are going to Texas or to Mexico because the odds of clear skies are best there. Also, the total eclipse will last longer in Texas than it will when it gets to Maine. So it will last as long as 4.5 minutes in Texas, which for a total solar eclipse is quite a long time. So Waco, where I will be, sits right near the center line of the path, which that means that it will be around the longest it can be. And again, it's in a part of Texas where the odds of clear skies are good.
Well, it just reinforces that everything's bigger in Texas. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with David Barron. He is the author of the book American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. What inspired you to write this story? This is about the people, about a group of scientists, various groups of scientists in 1878 that went to the Western U.S. to capture the eclipse, if you will. What inspired you to write this?
So, as I said, I saw my first total eclipse in 1998. And as a science writer, as soon as totality was over and I was just blown away by what I'd witnessed, I thought, I want to write about this. I want to write about it for a general audience and bring to life the excitement of a total eclipse. But the kind of writing I do, the science writing I do, sort of like what you do, is trying to bring science to a general public. And how do you make science interesting to people who don't think they care about science or don't think they understand science? And it, for me, it's all about good storytelling. If you can find a compelling story that happens to do with science, if it's a good enough story, people are just going to read it or listen to it. So I looked around for a really good eclipse story to tell. And it was pretty obvious early on that the best eclipse stories are not from today, but from the 19th century. Because during the 19th century, total solar eclipses weren't just interesting marvels to gawk at. They were keenly important for science. In fact, the late 19th century has been called the golden age of eclipse expeditions, because during that time, scientists, whenever a total eclipse was forecast pretty much anywhere on the globe, scientists would put together these elaborate expeditions to go to India or Africa or the Arctic for a total solar eclipse, an event that lasts all of 2 or 3 minutes usually, because during a total eclipse, the moon blocks the face of the sun and enables you to actually look at what's right around the sun, to look at the sun's atmosphere, to look at the really inner parts of the solar system. And that was so critical to understanding the sun and understanding the solar system that these, again, these grand expeditions were put together. So how I came to the 1878 eclipse, I mean, I was just looking at various eclipses. There was one in Thailand in 1868. There was one in the Mediterranean in 1870. There was one in India in 1871. And they're all great stories. But when I found out that in 1878, a total solar eclipse crossed America's Wild West at a time when the United States was out to prove itself as a scientific nation, and so here was its opportunity. And among the eclipse chasers who came to the Wild West was Thomas Edison, right before he invented the light bulb. I thought, well, there's got to be a book in that. And the deeper I went into researching the story, just the richer it became.
Well, even though it was the 19th century, there were still archaic beliefs about solar eclipses. I mean, we've talked with other people that have discussed the mythology behind eclipses, but that was, you know, centuries and decades ago. But in the 19th century, what were some of the prevailing beliefs?
Well, so you bring up a good point. There definitely were people who were spooked, and that is too mild a word, by the total eclipse. Although I should say the vast majority of Americans knew the eclipse was coming, understood it was nothing more than the moon passing between us and the sun, and were very excited for it. That said, there were a number of people, particularly in the southern part of the eclipse path in Texas, who were unaware that the eclipse was coming. So they were out in their farm fields on a hot July afternoon when all of a sudden the sun goes away. It goes dark in the middle of the afternoon. And they look up into the sky and the sun is gone. And instead what they see is this beautiful golden crown in the heavens. They were convinced that this was Judgment Day, that Christ was returning. And people fell to their knees in prayer. They ran to church. And as I recount in the opening of my book, there was one quite tragic event, a murder-suicide that was sparked by this, by a father who was convinced this was Judgment Day and he didn't want to stick around. He wanted to get to the other side as quickly as possible and to take his young son with him. And that was 1878. I mean, that was not that long ago. And yet the total eclipse sparked this intense fear.
Mm, that's such a wild story. And, you know, for the 3 or 4 minutes that father must have experienced, that it spurred him to take his own life and the life of his son. It sort of shows the impact of something like the total eclipse. And I will say in 2017, I made the huge mistake of not traveling 2 hours to the north to see the totality.
Yep.
And so I just didn't go because I thought it would be great here. Biggest mistake. And the impact that it makes on people, why do you think it is that?
Right. I don't want to rub it in. And you have plenty more eclipses you can go see, particularly if you're willing to travel overseas. But it's totally understandable, right? I mean, if you're going to have a 90% partial eclipse, isn't that almost as good as totality? And I know it sounds like I'm exaggerating, but it is a fundamentally different thing. During a total solar eclipse, daylight drops by a factor of a million. In a 90% partial eclipse, daylight drops by a factor of 10. In a 99% partial eclipse, it drops by a factor of 100. I could keep going, right? So even a 99% partial eclipse, you still have daylight. Yeah, it's dimmed by a factor of 100, but your eyes adjust. You still have direct light. It's when you're in the path of totality, it is those final seconds right before the moon completely covers the sun that you plunge into darkness. It's not like midnight, but like twilight. And it's like you suddenly wake up and you're on another planet. You are looking at a sky you've never seen before, because during the total eclipse, and only during the total eclipse, you can take those eclipse glasses off. You can look at the sun with the naked eye, and you will see a sun like none you've ever seen before. It is the most glorious sight in the heavens. It, as I said, it looks like a crown, or really more like a wreath. And it's got texture to it, like it's made out of tinsel, and it shimmers out in space. And here you are with your own eyes, looking at the center of the solar system, seeing the sun and the planets together. It is surreal and emotional and truly awe-inspiring. It's like a slap in the face that, oh my God, I'm floating through space. I'm on a tiny piece of rock, floating around as a giant star in a universe that's more vast than I can possibly imagine. And then it's over in 3 minutes and you wonder what just happened. It really is, I think, the most awe-inspiring sight in nature. And unless you experience it, it's very hard to understand what people like me are saying.
Absolutely. Okay, well, going back to your wonderful book, American Eclipse, you really look at the history behind the 1878 eclipse, and you talk about three people. You've already mentioned Thomas Edison, who's, of course, the most well-known of the three people. Let's talk a little bit about James Craig Watson, who, as you say, he hauled a telescope, a star chart, and his long-suffering wife out west. Oh, his poor wife. She obviously wasn't an umbrophile, right?
Well, she went with him on all sorts of journeys across the globe. And Annette Watson, she had a terrible husband, but a very exciting life. Yeah, James Craig Watson was a wonderful character to write about, but I would not have liked to have known him in real life. He was a pompous jerk, but he was a brilliant man. He was an astronomer at the University of Michigan who was best known for discovering asteroids. And back in the 19th century, there weren't that many asteroids that had yet been found, and they were considered planets. They were called minor planets because they are small bodies, but they orbit the sun just like the major planets. They were given names at that time, just like the major planets. And James Craig Watson was known as a planet hunter. And in 1878, for the eclipse, he had a particular goal in mind, and that was to find a planet. And not just any planet, but a planet called Vulcan, which, before it ever showed up on Star Trek, it was thought to be a real planet. Vulcan was a hypothetical planet in the 19th century that many astronomers thought had to exist between Mercury and the sun. Vulcan was thought to be the closest planet to the sun because Mercury's orbit suggested that there was a planet between it and the sun. Mercury behaved as if there was some large mass between it and the sun tugging it along. And astronomers, so they surmised there was this planet Vulcan. No one had ever reliably seen it, but that wasn't really a surprise. If a planet's that close to the sun, it's going to set with the sun. It's not going to be in the sky at night. You can't see it in the sky. In the daytime, right next to the sun, it's going to be lost in the sun's glare. But James Craig Watson figured during the total eclipse, during the 3 minutes when the moon blocks the face of the sun, he would scan right around the sun to look for Vulcan. And so that was one of the key efforts that was underway by him and others during the eclipse of 1878.
Well, let's get back to Edison for a minute, because we all know so much about Edison, his invention of the light bulb, but you go to a time prior to this. What was his role and his interactions with all of these astronomers?
So I just loved writing about Thomas Edison, because this is not the Edison most of us think of, right? This is not the old man who's become an icon of American science and invention. This was a young Thomas Edison, 31 years old, who had just become a global celebrity because of a different invention, and that was the phonograph, which was such a phenomenon. I mean, no one imagined it would ever be possible to capture and release sound. It's like capturing an echo. But the phonograph suddenly launched him to fame. And he, in 1878, decided to go west for the eclipse, because at that stage in his career, he wanted to be not just an inventor. He wanted to be an actual scientist. He wanted to help to solve some of the mysteries of nature. And he was friendly with a bunch of academic scientists, and they encouraged him to come along. So Edison came up with a new device specifically to study the eclipsed sun. It's a long forgotten invention called the tezimeter, which was an extremely sensitive heat detector that he claimed could measure differences in temperature as small as a millionth of a degree Fahrenheit. Basically, it was an infrared detector. You could point it at something and it would pick up heat coming off. And Edison thought he would use it to study the solar corona, this, which we know today is the sun's outer atmosphere. That's what you can see during the total eclipse. But at that point, no one knew what it was. And he was going to see if that beautiful halo gave off not just light, but heat, which could provide some clues to what it was. So that's what brought Edison to the West. It was just, but for him, I mean, he had an encounter with a gunslinger. He was riding on the cowcatcher of a train across the plains of the Midwest. I mean, he was just having a fun time as well. It was a vacation for him.
Well, did this experience for him affect how his invention of the light bulb or help spur him?
I believe it did. Now, there's a legend in Wyoming that Edison, you know, had a flash of inspiration and came up with the light bulb all of a sudden when he was in Wyoming. And that is a legend. That is not true. However, there are some ways in which the eclipse expedition inspired his work on the light bulb. One was just he was spending all this time in the presence of these prominent scientists, and they were talking about the challenge of electric power and lighting, which was something others were working on as well. And that encouraged him to think up new ideas when he got home. The eclipse expedition, as I said, it was a vacation for him. He had kind of burned out at the laboratory, and this recharged his batteries for when he got home. And as soon as he got home, the first thing he started working on was the light bulb. But there was also another thing, which was, I mentioned the tezimeter. Edison was a great showman, and he knew how to hype his inventions, which is very important for an entrepreneur to get investors and to get people excited. And he had been touting the tezimeter even before he figured out how to make it work. That was exactly what he did with the light bulb. As soon as he got back, he was using the same hype machine on his light bulb, claiming he had finally solved the problem of how to make a reliable light bulb before he knew what he was doing. But that gave him the time and the money to actually solve the problem. I mean, he was walking on a high wire there. He could very easily have failed. But because he knew how to manipulate the press and get his investors involved, he actually was able to then work out the problem and come up with the first successful incandescent lamp.
Wow. We're having a conversation with science journalist David Barron, and he's talking about his book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. And David, you came out with this book in 2017, I believe.
Correct.
And so it's sort of being re-released now in advance of the April 8th total eclipse, and you've added to it. Tell us about that.
So my publisher approached me a couple of years ago and said, you know, we've got another total solar eclipse coming up in 2024. We'd like to come up with a revised edition of your book. And I thought, revised edition? This is a historical tale. What am I going to revise? So after some discussion, what we decided made sense was that I would write what's called an afterword, basically an essay about what's happened since the book first came out. And the main thing that's happened is my book originally came out right before the total eclipse of 2017. So in my afterword, I mostly write about that eclipse, which, as we already discussed, was a really big deal. I mean, that was the first total eclipse to cross the United States coast to coast in 99 years. It was a big national celebration that day. There was wall-to-wall news coverage, on broadcast TV. Millions of people went to see it as a total eclipse. It was a partial eclipse across the rest of the country. And it came at a time when it felt like our country was honestly falling apart, like we were on the verge of a civil war. It was the early days of the Trump administration. You had red and blue America just battling it out. A week before the total eclipse was the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville that turned deadly. And yet, on this one day, everyone came together for something that was apolitical, that was unifying instead of dividing. And not that it changed the trajectory of this country, but it showed we could come together. You had people from Boulder, where I live, a pretty liberal place, going up to Wyoming. You had folks from Manhattan going down to Tennessee. You had red and blue America mixing and people just enjoying the day. And so that's what I really reflect on in the afterword. And I think the same thing's going to happen on April 8th of this year.
Yeah, well, I was going to say we are no less in that same sort of division in our country now in 2024. It's interesting that in those 7 years, not a lot has changed in terms of that. But yes, let us come together, because as we all experience the eclipse, it's the same thing that we're all experiencing. Like, there is no division between the experience, I don't think. Or what are your thoughts?
I mean, certainly there are outliers. I mean, at any total eclipse, there are the few who say that this is, you know, that Armageddon's coming and that sort of thing. But that's really fringe. I've been giving talks virtually, and will be giving them in person, from Texas to Indiana to Maine. Everyone's excited. And it not only is it something that brings us together because it's a shared experience at a time when we're all, you know, siloed in our entertainment and getting individualized news feeds, it's like we're living in different universes. Here's one thing that we're all going to experience together and pretty much in the same way. But there's another level too, which is there's been a lot of research in recent years into the phenomenon of awe. The psychology of awe. What is it about seeing an awe-inspiring sight, the Grand Canyon, looking out over the ocean, and particularly a total solar eclipse? What is it? What does it do to our brain? And it's been shown that experiencing awe, in essence, dissolves the ego. We don't think of ourselves as individuals anymore. We think of ourselves as part of a collective, and part of everything. And seeing a total solar eclipse is a real bonding experience, certainly with friends and loved ones, but even with strangers. It's that everyone is celebrating being alive at this moment and this place. And so there is this sense of unification that we had in 2017 and we will have on April 8th of this year.
Well, there was one person that I think is very important that we need to talk about from the book, when that was Maria.
Mariah Mitchell.
Yeah. Tell us about her and her all-female expedition from Vassar College. That had to have been pretty extreme for that day.
Absolutely.
Unheard of, unconventional.
Right. Yeah. Mariah Mitchell is my favorite character, and many readers tell me that she is theirs as well. So, as you said, there are three main characters and many secondary characters in my book. But besides Thomas Edison and James Craig Watson, the third main character is by far the most famous female scientist in America in the 19th century. Her name was Mariah Mitchell. She was an astronomer. By 1878, she was on the verge of 60, teaching astronomy at Vassar College, which at that time was a new all-women's college in Poughkeepsie, New York. And she was a staunch advocate for women's education at a time when women's education was considered kind of this risky social experiment. In fact, just a few years before, a prominent Boston doctor came out with what was a best-selling book that made the claim in all seriousness that female college students, by using their brains too much, risked harming their physical health. The claim was that if a maturing woman used her brain too much, she sapped energy from her reproductive organs and thereby would turn into a sterile masculine invalid. And this caused a panic, a sense that, you know, having women go to college, this was going to harm a whole generation of America's women. Well, Mariah Mitchell thought this was ridiculous. She encouraged young women to use their brains in her astronomy courses at Vassar. But she had to do something else. She needed to convince American society that this whole idea was crazy. And so in 1878, when groups of men were assembling eclipse expeditions to the Wild West, many of them with logistical and financial support from the federal government, she took it upon herself to assemble an all-female expedition that went to Denver. And it's just a wonderful story of these women coming together and on their own going out to Colorado for this three-minute event. It was a scientific expedition, just like the others, but there's a whole other layer to it as well. It kind of was political theater to show the American public that women could be smart and educated and healthy and feminine as well.
And still be able to reproduce.
Right, exactly.
I love it. Well, David Barron, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. The book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. And have a wonderful time in Waco. And I just want to ask you before, because Katie and I have been batting around the idea of going, sitting on a plane, even if it's just for the day, right? If we miss this, when is the next one that we will catch in this country?
It's going to be a while. So in the contiguous 48 United States, the next one will not be until 2044. And that one's just, I think it goes over Montana. It doesn't go over much of the country. However, August 12th, 2045, that's the one I'm waiting for. That one will go across Utah and Colorado, where I live. It'll go from California to Florida, and that one will last in this part of the country over 5 minutes. That's a very long time. And the place I'm going to be on August 12th, 2045 is on top of Pikes Peak, because if I could have been anywhere in 1878 to see that eclipse, it would have been the top of Pikes Peak, because the people up there had an astonishing view looking to the northwest. They saw the moon's shadow as this palpable curtain of black moving in at them 2,000 miles an hour. That's what I want to see. So I'm going to be on top of Pikes Peak, August 12th, 2045, looking west for the moon's shadow. So you can join me up there.
I love it. Not many people can plan 20 years out for a single 5-minute event, but that's great. David, thank you so much. It's been great speaking with you.
It was great talking to both of you.
David Barron, former science correspondent for NPR and an umbrophile. Now that word is fully cemented in our vocabulary.
I think we all hope to be umbrophiles.
How many of our listeners are going to see the total eclipse?
Let us know.
Send us a text or an email.
Yeah, we'd love to know your stories when you get back.
Yeah, we're trying to find a flight right now.
Somewhere in Dallas.
Who knows?
If anybody wants to send the Cool Science Radio team to Dallas for an interview, you let us know. We'll be happy to go.
That's right. We'll be your representatives. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
In 1962, a book was released that really defined the global climate movement as we know it, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Today, award-winning author and our next guest, Anne Berg, has penned Rachel's story for young readers to introduce them to a scientific icon. It's called Force of Nature, and it tells the story of the life, inspiration, and impact of Rachel Carson. Anne Berg, we'd like to welcome you to Cool Science Radio.
And I'm so happy to be here.
I think we have all heard about Rachel Carson. I remember first hearing about it, probably in some college class, and Silent Spring, and how it was so impactful. And I don't really know the breadth of the influence. So let's just start there.
It's amazing. Rachel opened Silent Spring with a fable for tomorrow. and what the world would be like, what had happened or what inspired her. To go back just a little bit, was that she's usually writing books about the ocean, and she had decided after three books about the ocean and the National Book Award, her next book was going to be about the earth. And she, she loved nature and grew up in nature. And just about the time she was ready to start her new book, bad things were happening. Birds were falling from the sky with their bills open, gaping wide, and their claws splayed. And she was doing research and realized that DDT had been was being used for everything. And during the war, during the World War II, DDT kept disease from spreading because it killed the lice and the mosquitoes. And then after the war, we just took it to home with us, and farmers used it on the farms, and they used it in gardeners used it in their backyard gardens. I read an article in 1957 in North Dakota that said, for winter woolens, the best way to clean winter woolens, since you can't wash them, is to spray them with the miracle DDT. So DDT was not just used, it was overused. And what was happening was that the poison pesticide was sinking into the soil. And first the birds munching on their worms. And eventually it was a part of our food chain. And Rachel was afraid that it wasn't gonna confine itself to, the poison wasn't gonna be just confined to a few species. So she wrote Silent Spring again, with the opening of bringing us in to see a world we didn't have the birds. What would it be like? And she created this, and then went into a more scientific discussion of it. But I would also say that even in her science, everything she writes is poetry. So.
So it's interesting that you first bring up DDT, because it makes me wonder where we are now, you know, from so long ago, looking at DDT and realizing how harmful it was. And it's been in the last 10 years or so, I was somewhere where they regularly spray DDT through the streets, you know, it was Cuba.
Oh, I was going to say, because it was banned in 1972 in the United States, but...
Right. But you know, around the world, how is something like that still used? And, you know, it shows the evolution of how we have not come far enough.
We have not come far enough. I just have to tell you the story. I met a bookseller a couple of weeks ago, who told me that she remembers the planes spraying the DDT, and the children, because the planes are flying low, would be underneath them waving and laughing. And I thought the DDT had no smell, but she distinctly remembers a sweet smelling fog that the kids were running through. So, that's in memory of the people that are here now. We really have not come that far at all. We really haven't. And I think it's important, because I almost want to, you know, shake people and say, this is not new. You know, this is not news. This is not new news, climate change, or that things are happening on Earth that are because of us, because of our choices. And it's kind of amazing, which is why I think we need to shine a light on Rachel again.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Anne Berg. She is the author of Force of Nature, a novel of Rachel Carson. Well, Anne, how did you choose Rachel Carson? You've got an extensive backlist of other diverse topics, but what was it about Rachel that drew you to her?
Well, actually, it was climate change, because I myself am not that scientific minded, and I was sniffing around for a new story, but I was also trying to grasp what is the relationship between humankind and climate change. And her name kept popping up. She, you know, mostly with the same quote that mostly with a quote that she about us being connected and being responsible for the earth. And I was like, you know what? All I know about her is Silent Spring. I know nothing about this woman. And so curiosity is always the first step in writing. And so started reading about her. And it just seemed like she was, we needed to resurrect her and remind people that this, first of all, is not, it's not new that we should be caring about the earth, that people have thought this for a very long time. So that kind of drew me in. And then when I read about her, she's an interesting person. She changed the world, really. But she was a quiet, solitary child. So I liked what she captured and could capture, I hoped, for kids.
Well, like you just ended this, you wrote this for kids. This is a middle grade reader book, and it's written in a free verse is what they call it. How did you decide to write that way? And will kids actually respond better to this free poetic verse that you write instead of the lengthy paragraphs and sentences and the typical storytelling that we see?
Yeah, I think this is my fourth verse novel, and for me, it's easier because I'm like channeling the character or the person that I'm writing about, and I think that it's easier for kids too. First of all, there's a lot of white space on the page, so for the reluctant reader, I can read five pages in it in no time, and it's not really bogged down with. You get to see the world through, you get a distilled kind of vision of the world. I mean, there's so much going on in our lives and so many things to distract us that I think, I myself think that, and I've heard from kids, that this is a good way for them to read it and get it clearer, clarified as they're going. They know what they're reading, it's a single person speaking. So I think it works.
And was your decision to write in this way influenced at all by the fact that, you know, as you have already talked about, that Rachel Carson was a poet herself and said that you couldn't really write about, what was it? You couldn't really write about nature without using poetry, which is a really beautiful way to look at nature.
I wish I could say that, but actually it's more of my own way of going into a story. I actually wrote my first verse novel was about an Amerasian boy who's airlifted over during the Vietnam War. And I tried so many ways to get into that story. And then one day I saw a picture of a child, and it was like he was sitting on my shoulder, and I just told the story through his voice. And then I found that it was easier for me, and maybe just like I'm talking about for students to, or kids to read something with just a kind of singular vision, it was easier for me to write. It's easier for me to concentrate. And this story lent itself to that because Rachel herself, I was seeing the world through Rachel's eyes.
That's really nice. And also, are you in some way hopefully inspiring kids to write in this way that might, you know, as you say, in our distracted world, it may be so much easier to write in this free verse form, which I kind of, as I see it on the page, I look at it as like snippets, but snippets, yes, are what we gather as information, yes, now really readily.
I agree. And I would love, I do sometimes visit schools, and I do have kids speak in first person, and just don't worry about sentence. Here's another thing. Don't worry about sentence construction and periods and commas. Like, and I'm an English teacher, and I respect grammar very much. But when you're writing, you can't, you know, you can't have a preposition at the end of a sentence. You can't, which I just found out is not true. But I was brought up with no prepositions at the end of the sentence. So if I'm writing in a more normal way or a prose way, I don't end my sentences with prepositions. But when I'm speaking as a character, well, that's how we talk. And so it's easier. So I find it very freeing, and I think that the kids would find it freeing too.
Well, did Rachel Carson start out as a writer, or was she on a separate path?
No, she started out as a writer, and she's been writing since she was a child. One of her first books was a gift for her father about always about nature, about the animals outside. And it was just an expected thing that she would become a writer because she'd been writing forever, and also because writing was a respectable career for a woman. There weren't too many things that women could do. Her mom was a teacher, but had to quit teaching when she got married. She was definitely going to be a writer. She was known in her college, Pennsylvania College for Women, as the one of the best writers in the school. And then she took a biology class, and her love of nature it was like she could get even closer to what she loved, under that microscope. And she fell in love with biology. She fell in love with biology as the fabric of life. And I gotta say, I was never a nature person, but when I saw nature through her eyes, when she was in biology and she, whatever I was reading explained what she saw, then I went online and to see what she was talking about. Well, it is pretty amazing. I mean, there is so much stuff that we don't know or that we just take for granted. Like there's a poem in there, in a puddle of water, what she saw.
Did she actually end up studying more science, or was she
Yes,
really
and then
just a writer with a couple of biology classes?
she loved biology so much that even though it was late in her college career, she switched majors, much to the chagrin of everyone. Her friends, her professors were like, "Don't do this. This is you're going to be so limited. Only men are in this field. You'll be frustrated. You'll be watching them climb the ladder, and you'll be holding it." She believed in herself. She was a quiet child. She was an introverted in a ways, but she had courage, and she had confidence in what she saw and believed, which is what I would love for readers to get out of that. That she changed her major. She got a job at the fisheries, the U.S. Department of Fisheries, then she wasn't making enough money. She was working researching during the day, work writing at night. She ended up writing three books about the ocean. So she said at one point, and I'm not quite sure what point it may have been. I don't remember what point she said this, that she never gave up writing. She just finally found what she wanted to write about, and that was nature.
Well, you, Anne, have written this book for young adults, as we've already said. And I'm wondering, I mean, there's so much that we're still talking, especially to young girls, about getting into STEM-related interests and courses and majors and careers. And we have to start early in giving them that confidence. Talk about the connection there with why you chose to write this book.
That's exactly it. I think we see, well, we've been talking about this now. People read and they see them, they can see themselves. And so here's it, if you have a child who's interested in things, interested in nature and wants to explore, then you have to encourage that. And here you have Rachel, who didn't get a lot of encouragement and was able to do it, and was able to do it well. And to imprint this planet in a positive way. So I think that I don't know. I know that out there somewhere is another Rachel Carson. I don't know her name, but I want her to know that I believe in her, and that her time will come if she's true to herself. I mean, that was Rachel's thing. She was true to herself.
Wow, being true to oneself is a concept that is so hard to impress upon young people, especially because they're so concerned with being true to whatever everyone
Exactly.
surrounding them
Exactly.
wants them to be. And you know, it's funny, this conversation is taking all kinds of different directions because there is a story here about our young people. There's a story about the way you've written the book, and then there's a story about Rachel Carson, which I really love. Rachel, I'm forgetting when she died. It's been in the last, what, couple decades?
1962, I think. 62.
Oh, Oh, way, way sooner than I thought. Okay. How did it go for her upon after, you know, she, as you talked about, she had written several books and she wrote Silent Spring. And how was that received at the time? It almost seems like after her death is when it really launched into being this sort of Bible for the nascent environmental movement.
She had befriended many scientists who respected her work and thought it was wonderful, but it was not well received by many male chauvinistic scientists with advanced degrees. Rachel wanted to go on to get her doctorate, and she couldn't afford to. She had a lot of family responsibilities, and she didn't. So they kind of treated her as like, well, as if she had a lesser degree because she wasn't as advanced as they were. And she was in a lot, the chemical companies, the chemical CEOs, they all belittled her. They called her the little lady with the perfectly coiffed hair and red nails. And she's challenging us, we who know and have studied with our, you know. So it wasn't really well received at the time. But she was, you know, she's interviewed by CBS. She appeared before Congress. She had a lot to say, and she said it. And she was sick when she said it. She herself was sick with cancer, and she was afraid that it would come out, and then they'd say, "Oh, this is just you're just getting back at everyone because you have cancer and stuff." And it wasn't that way at all. She was writing because she cared about our planet and she cared about our Earth. So eventually, as I tell myself every day now, eventually truth manifests. So 10 years after Silent Spring, DDT was banned in the United States. I don't know why other countries still use it, but.
With all of your research and getting to know Rachel Carson like you did for this book, how has she changed your view of nature and how you look at nature?
Oh, this is a very great question, very good question that I think about a lot. Because when I was growing up, you were either math and science or you were literature, and you were really outdoorsy or you were booky. You couldn't be both. And so When Rachel received the John Burroughs Award for nature writing, and she said that there really wasn't such a thing as nature writing, where she said that there's poetry in nature. If there's poetry in my books, it's because there's poetry in nature. She went on to say, which has truly changed like a lens in my eye, that science, you know, the purpose of science is to discover and illuminate truth. That was her starting of it. And then she said, and that I believe is the purpose of literature, whether fiction or poetry or history. So we're really the same thing. And so I just feel like science is not something like to me, you know, I grew up with poetry, but I know instinctively that poetry is not just pretty words, just like she knows instinctively that science is not just facts, that there's beauty there. So there's beauty in both poetry and science. So that has changed me. I mean, every book I read changes me, every book I write changes me, and that's how she has changed me. I still confess that I take the shoe when I see a spider in my house, but I am trying, and I can't wait to do what her mother taught her to do and my child does, but I'm not yet brave enough. I get a glass, you put the glass over the spider, you slip the paper under the glass, and you bring the spider outside. I'm not there yet, but that's on my bucket list.
Well, with your book, you're going to help all of the young readers be able to deal better with spiders. And one thing in the book is you have some of her field notes. Do you hope that inspires kids to go out and make their own field notes? Because I think so many kids are just walking around with their phones.
Right. Well, I wrote the field notes, but she herself did write field notes, and she would carry a notebook with her and then copy them over to onto index cards. I mean, she was very organized. And I would love that. I would love that to keep a book with you. But see, here's another thing. So as a writer, you keep a book with you, like you hear over here a conversation or you hear a phrase you want to say, remember. But now I notice nature more. I notice the puddle. I wonder what's floating in the puddle. I notice it's a totally different way of looking at things. But I would love for kids to remember to do that. You know, I'm not against all video, but they do need to put it down sometime and actually see the world.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's called Force of Nature. Our guest is Anne Bird. She's an award-winning author. And this is a story for young readers, but you know what? It's a story for everyone, especially those who want to feel the inspiration of Rachel Carson, who maybe, you know, have gone, like all of us, all these years hearing about Silent Spring, not really knowing much more than that about Rachel Carson. So,
yeah, if I could say one last thing,
yeah.
It was written for children, but I really think she changed my life. And I think that at all ages, you could, if you read about her and know what she felt and know what she accomplished, it will benefit your life and benefit our planet.
Really well said. Anne, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. And best of luck.
Lovely meeting you both. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne.
And that was Anne Berg. Her book is Force of Nature, all about Rachel Carson. We want to thank her as well as David Barron, who talked about the eclipse, the history of the eclipse, and the upcoming eclipse on April 8th, going from Mazatlan, Mexico,
Buffalo,
Maine.
New York.
Yeah.
Up through Maine.
And we've been searching for a flight so far.
We're a little behind the eight ball on this one. We should have done this months ago.
Well, thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. We'll be back after this. Just a quick mention of a series coming up at the Natural History Museum of Utah, starting on April 2nd. From 7 to 8:30 p.m. This is actually taking place at Kingsbury Hall, but it's called The Science of Intelligence, and it's underwritten by the Natural History Museum of Utah. This is it's the 2024 lecture series Keynote with David Eagleman. I encourage you to look that up.